just to say a few more words about what we were talking about yesterday before moving on. So we ran out of time just when we were talking about the question of kavod for a kala, and the idea that we certainly seem to find here, is that an independent obligation of kavod, or is that a reflection of the mitzvah of simcha? And we basically thought it could really be said three ways, that either kavod exists in and of itself, or kavod really is just because that's an aspect of simcha, that it will make the chassan and kala happy to see that you are prioritizing their needs, or that the correlation goes the other way, that really simcha is a form of kavod. The whole point of simcha, like we see from many statements, particularly on our daf, is about l'chabe v'shal baila, to make the husband have a full sense of appreciation for his wife, and therefore acts of kavod are really symbolic, if that's a word, or really symbolic and emblematic, of what the notion of Simchas Chasam Kala is supposed to be about. So just to say another word or two about that. So first of all, there is a source in the Maseches Machlos which expands on the story of Agrippus here. The Gemara tells us that Agrippus was willing to step aside to let the Kala take priority. And the Gemara asks, is that really appropriate? So he's a king, and don't we say that Melech Machol Klodo and Klodo Machol? So the Gemara gives an answer, and the Rishonim talk about it. So in the Maseches Machlos, it adds a little bit more. It says that the king says, King Agrippa says, I get to wear my crown all year round. She has the crown for an hour, so let's let her have her hour. So what does that sound like a little bit? It kind of sounds like she has a crown, so to speak, that she has a component of kavod that emerges from status, and that maybe it's not really more than the king, so that's why the king really ideally comes first. But he said, listen, she's also got a crown, she only gets it for this brief time, so let's have Rachmanis on her and let her use it. So even though, strictly speaking, he should win, but the notion seems to be that there is the status of Malchus, as you're familiar with the notion that you find in some rabbinic sources, of Chasen Domo L'Melech. And the idea that Chasen and Kala, that the bride and groom, have, by virtue of what they're doing, a certain Malchus status. So that gets involved, by the way, in the Shaila, if you ever go to a wedding. So you know when they have the processional down to the chuppah, so the chassan comes down with his parents, and people tend to stand up, and then the kala walks down with the parents, and people tend to stand up. It's all very nice. It's a question, alpi halacha, is there a basis for this? Some rabbanim point out quite correctly that it's a little bit backwards, that everyone stands up for the chassan and for the kala, and they don't stand up for the grandparents who came in front of them, because that's actually a pasuk in Chumash, and they say the takum, that you have a chiyuv to stand up for the grandparents, that seems to be much more explicit. So if you have to figure out which one's a real din, it seems standing up for the grandparents is more of an actual din than standing up for the chassan or the kala.
Also standing up for them, maybe another reason for that is because they're complete tzaddikim by it.
So getting back to what we discussed in Parsha Share a little bit last week, kind of just to get back to that a little bit, the whole idea of Kaparas Avonos on the day of the wedding may actually be relevant to this. So if we want to assume that there is some kind of the chiyuv to stand up for the chasana and the kala or the kala, so what's that based on? So it's based on the idea of Malchus, that we want to show kavod. So then we could understand maybe there is such a notion, and maybe it should apply equally to the chasen and the kala. Certainly from this perspective of our Gemara, it seems the kala is certainly part of the picture. There are those who suggest, I believe Rebecca Kamenetsky had a suggestion along these lines, that the idea of standing up for, say, the chasen is not because of any notion of malchus per se, but that there is an idea, it's based on a tosefta about the bikurim, that you should stand up for osei mitzvah. That when somebody comes in front of you and he's doing a mitzvah in public, so then we should stand out of respect for the mitzvah. It's actually interesting, it also relates again within our sugya. So yesterday we talked about the obligation of levayas hametz, and we mentioned that it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, that if you're not walking with the mace, at least you have to stand up when the mace passes. So there is a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch, is that standing up because of kavod hameis, you're showing respect out to the meis, or is the idea that the malave hameis are osei mitzvah, that there are people walking past you who are involved in a mitzvah, and therefore it's appropriate to stand up for them. There is such a discussion. So it could be that the standing for the chasen and kala is really about the mitzvah. And then there is a whole discussion, okay, if it's a mitzvah, so who's doing the mitzvah? Are they both doing the mitzvah? This is a whole discussion. We mentioned in the first week that there is a mitzvah of kiddushin according to the Rambam and Sefer Achinuch. So that mitzvah of kiddushin is, it sounds like, only on the man as a chiyuv. However, there is a Ran, the Ran in the beginning of the second paragraph of Kiddushin, where the Ran is Mechadesh, that, which is very understandable, that you have a process which requires another party and is not going to work without that party, so then that party plays a crucial assisting role, and therefore that's also called a mitzvah. Same way you find in the other direction that helping to do an Aveira is called, when you're a crucial part, it's called the Nisr Daraisa with Meider, and if you're not a crucial part, it's the Nisr Drabanan, the Sayeya, the Ovri Aveira. So it seems to have the same kind of structure when it comes to mitzvos as well. The Ran notes there, because the Gemara, in the beginning of the second paragraph of Kiddushin, and Daf Mem Aleph, so the Gemara talks about the idea of mitzvah bo yosemi b'shulchov. The Gemara says that explicitly in the context of Kiddushin, which was also a topic for last week's Parsha Shir. We were talking about whether Eliezer was a shliach for Kiddushin. So the Sfarim ask, you know, if that's true, don't we say that a shliach for Kiddushin, the Gemara says, is really not the ideal way of doing things? That it exists as a concept, but we discourage it. Maybe it's going to come back in favor of those who have joked that maybe we'll bring it back so that we can have more kibudim. If you have a shliach l'kiddushin, so you have too many people you need to give a kibud to at the wedding, so if you want to be mani shliach, so you'll be able to throw in another one. Satmar Rebbe, I think, joked that it used to be that in the olden days, they wouldn't have seven different rabbanim recite Shabbat Brachas. They'd have one rabbi get up there and recite all Shabbat Brachas. It's only more recently they want to have more slots for kibudim, so they divide them up. So he had joked that the day's going to come when they'll call up one person for bu and one person for rich. You know, the first word, burich, will be split up into two so that they can have extra kibudim. So sometimes if you need to try to create extra kibudim, so maybe if you want to do that, we'll put shliach l'kedusha in the middle, so that we'll have an extra person up there. But that won't necessarily be a problem according to Chazal. The Gemara in the second part of Kiddushin says that it's not ideal to have a shliach l'kiddushin because the premise is, which is a kasha you could ask them in Yitzchak and Eliezer also, is that if you have a shliach l'kiddushin, it's happening off-site somewhere, and off-site, S-I-T-E, and out of sight, S-I-G-H-D, so the chassan is not actually meeting the kala, and shouldn't we worry that maybe it's not going to be a good shliach, maybe he's not going to be happy with it, and the Gemara says, if you have to l'ayach l'kamocha, shouldn't be worried about that. So it's not so ideal. So in that context, the Gemara says, mitzvah bo, yosum v'shlucho. So the Gemara also uses that language for her too. The Gemara says, mitzvah ba, yosum v'shlucho. So the Ran asks, I was asked, well, mitzvah ba, is there a mitzvah on the woman? Is that true? Is she really obligated? So the Ran there has that idea that there's a mixas mitzvah, that since she's obviously a crucial part of the story, so her assistance in this happening counts as a mitzvah too. So this gets the whole discussion, which we had to keep brief last week in order to keep it in the parsha, but the whole question of the fast for the chasen and kala. So as we mentioned, I think I alluded to the fact that it's a very complicated question, that if you come and you say to the rabbi that, listen, I don't think I can fast on the day of the wedding, can we be makel here? So we discussed the various approaches to that last week. But in general, so the approach is always to be a little bit more makel for the kala than for the chasen. So why is that? Because they put together all the different possibilities. So what exactly is the reason for the fast? Is it because it's the kaparas avonos? Is it because we don't want it to be shichrus? So they try to figure out, do all of these considerations apply equally to the kala as to the chasen? So if it's a bad shichrus, then does her need for being of sober mind exist on the same level? What exactly is the role of the kinyan? That's the whole discussion. If you say that it's about the kapara, so what causes the kapara? Is the kapara from performing a mitzvah? Is it accepting responsibility? So in that discussion, you get into the whole story. Is she performing a mitzvah on the same level? Is she performing a little bit of a mitzvah? So that becomes a whole lumdus. It happens to be that when the Ramah brings this minig, remember correctly, the Ramah does say that there is a minig for the chasen and the challah to fast. He mentions them both. But in the later svarim, they kind of re-examined the issue, and they wondered if there are grounds to be mechalik based on the lumdus of the minig. So in general, it's a question. So this idea of standing for the principles at the wedding, is that because of kavod, or is that because of the mitzvah? And then you can figure out exactly what the mitzvah is. And again, when it comes to the grandparents, it would seem that that's a straight out din of kavod. Hi.
I've heard, like, third hand, that Moshe wouldn't stand up for when the bride and groom would pass by. Sponsored because it was like chukas akum or something like that.
Could be. So, you know, certainly possible, because like I said, the idea of trying to figure out exactly what the concept is based on is kind of a working backwards, kind of reverse engineering approach. The assumption is that maybe it's based on something, so it could be that he felt it wasn't based on anything. That's a possibility, or maybe it is based on the idea of kavod, or maybe it's based on this idea of mitzvah, which there are sources for as well. So I just happened to notice, I don't know if we've mentioned it all this year, Ehidus Svarim, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein. He's a fascinating, fascinating Svarim. He's a well-known posek in Eretz Yisrael, and he has many, many Svarim. Every week they seem to come out with another sefer of his Torah in one form or another. It's very popular nowadays. So he has a Svarim on the Masechtas, which I think is Daf Yomi Shem, so it's very, make sure to have something on every Daf, and they're usually very, very fascinating types of halacha l'maaseh questions. So I just noticed that he has on this daf. So he asks that what should the story be? Let's say you have two kosos. You want to use one kos at the end of the wedding. You want to use one for benching and one for shava brachos. So one is gold and one is silver. So which one should you use for which? So he considers the question there. Now, on the one hand, benching is Mehat Torah, so you think, okay, so maybe that should take priority because that's bigger chiyuv than Shabbat Brachos, which is Rabban. But then he considers that Shabbat Brachos is for the kavod of the Kala, and he quotes this Maseches Machos about the Kala having the crown and the idea of being like a Melech. So the Melech consideration is that a king Darko Bazov, so maybe you should say that the gold cup should dafka be for the Shadow Brachos. He has this question. Well, Maisi thinks that he quotes others that say that the Chiyuv Shara, the Chiyuv Brachos Hamazon, has the greater obligation, but it's an interesting type of Shiloh. Parenthetically, in terms of the crown, to use actual crowns at a wedding is a problem. I think, okay, that makes sense based on what we're saying. But the Gemara says in the Book of Basra that they used to do that, that we don't do that anymore because of the Churban HaBayis, that the post-Churban era is not appropriate, so now we have a mucker in the Gemara that nowadays that dafka shouldn't be done. But theoretically, one could have thought that maybe that symbolism is appropriate based on this king and queen kind of idea.
Didn't we see some
translation of Shabbat Brachos is Deraisa? That maybe the Simcha of Shabbat Brachos is Deraisa, but that's also kind of maybe one day of Simcha of Shabbat Brachos is Deraisa, which the minority view in the Rishonim. We don't kind of paskin like that, but also the bracha, the recitation of the bracha on wine, that's hard to say is Deraisa. I mean, benching on wine is also not Deraisa. Benching itself is Deraisa. So the mitzvah is Deraisa. The kavod of the mitzvah that comes from the coast is an act of kavod towards the mitzvah there is, where it's coming from.
Is there also consideration Zilberstein about tadir v'sheino tadir v'nekodim?
He doesn't mention that discussion. Is that, I guess, theoretically, say benching is certainly more tadir than the wedding.
That's why he drew.
Okay, something to think about. But what he does mention, which is probably more relevant, is that you make the bracha first. They make Berachas HaMazon first. So therefore you also have the fact that they have Avir and all the mitzvot, so that whatever mitzvah you're doing first, maybe you should think should have a priority. Okay. It's an interesting question. So now, with that, before I go into the Mishnah straight, just want to mention, say, 2 points about the sugyas in the middle that hopefully you got a chance to see in the Gemara. So again, we're familiar with the idea of Mota B'Mitzvahs, and you know, the maze that comes up in the Gemara, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'll just mention 2 points. One was also, while I was noticing the previous discussion in the Yitzchak Silverstein Sefer, so I noticed another interesting halakha l'maisa discussion that he has there, the next point, which is about the Gemara in between, that the Gemara discusses an exception to the Mota B'Mitzvahs rule, the idea of Meshev Aveda. Right, what's the din of Meshev Aveda? If you have a scenario where somebody doesn't really have to say anything at all, right, so he's helping the other guy out by acknowledging a certain debt to this person or a certain property of this person, so then maybe it doesn't make sense. Chazal were afraid we shouldn't make this guy take a shvu as a motiv mixas, because they'll say, why should I get involved in the first place? And that's based on the idea of Meshev Aveda, that if we were to say, let's say I find something, and I turn it over to the owner, and the owner says, no, that's not the whole thing, I had twice as much, you must have stolen half of it. And hey, you're trying to be a big hero and returning this lost money, and I know that you actually took half of it, and you're only returning the other half, so I'm going to call you a Moshe B'Mitzvahs, and you should have to take a shtur. So the Gemara says, Chazal made a takana, that that's not the way to go, because the person's not going to want to ever get involved in returning lost property. If you see something on the beach and you're going to want to return it, you can think, no, it's not a good idea to get involved, right? Because I could end up in worse shape. But if I come and I return it, maybe he's going to tell me that, oh, you probably stole the other half, and he's going to make me take a shur. So I don't want to do this, so that's a bad deal. So therefore, in order to not discourage the Meshivei Aveda, or not to discourage people who find lost property, so they made a takana that we don't apply the din of Moshe B'Mitzvahs, and person is patur. So this may be a little bit reminiscent. This is actually a student asked me about this in the business ethics class, that we know nowadays that there is a reality in the litigious society that we live in America, that people are always afraid of being sued, and doctors and first responders are also susceptible to being sued. And one could legitimately worry that doesn't that kind of discourage people from helping others? That if you know that by getting involved and trying to help somebody, they could end up suing you because you didn't do a good enough job or whatever claim they could have. So one could understandably worry that maybe that's a bad policy because you're going to discourage people from being involved in saving lives. So it happens to be that Yitzchak Silverstein has a discussion about a very similar point on this daf over here, on daf Yechez, that he comments on this notion of Meshev Aveda Pater. He says that the following scenario. He says, a man had a heart attack. And they called Hatzalah, they called Magen David Adom, and the paramedics came, and the paramedics saved the guy's life. And afterwards, the guy claimed, he's angry, he said that he had a gold watch. And he thinks the paramedic took it. So he wants him to take a shvua d'rabbanan, shvua sasis, that he didn't take the watch. So the paramedic's very angry. He says, here, I don't have to come save your life at all. I come and save your life, I come and do a good deed, and this is what happens to me? I should end up having to take a shvua? So what do you think? What should the din be? Should you have to take a shvua? So it seems like it's a similar kind of situation. So he discusses, based on this Gemara, that it seems like it's a canon of Meshev Aveda logic in play here, and then he has a long parenthesis telling me about experiences that he has dealing with people. Rav Zilberstein happens to be a big posek involved in medical shalas. He talks to a lot of doctors and a lot of people in the healing profession. So they relate to him the stories that they get involved in things, and then people get upset and they end up suing them, and you might think that better not to have tried to help in the first place. So what's the story with this guy? Should we say that he's a Meshev Aveda, and therefore the same logic that says that this person is off the hook for Mota B'Mitzvahs, we should let him off the hook also for this case with a stolen watch?
It's not the Meshev Aveda, he's paid to do it.
That may or may not be true. He doesn't necessarily have to get involved in the profession to begin with. Also, if that's very significant, we could tweak the Shilohs for theoretical purposes. That's assuming that he is a volunteer. Happens to be that a lot of people doing these kind of things are not paid. But let's assume either it doesn't make much of a difference, because it probably doesn't, or that if you think it does make a difference, then let's ask the question in terms of volunteer. So what would you say? Is it comparable? Is it not comparable? So the logic seems to match, as he notes there. But he said there is a chiluk you could make, which may kind of throw a monkey wrench into the whole thing. It's really a technicality, but it might be enough of a technicality. What's the difference between that case and this case? Well, in this case, the case in the Gemara, you're basically saying that the money that I return to you, I am immune from a claim that it's not the whole story. Because otherwise, maybe I wouldn't want to return it in the first place. So I'm not subject, I have to take a shvua because of that. In this case, the case that was described, which is not necessarily the same kind of case as some of the lawsuits that you hear about, but specifically the case that we just described, there's two different claims here. He came and saved the guy's life, and that's great. No one has any complaint about that. Independently, he says, while you were saving my life, you also stole my watch. So, technically speaking, the situation is a little bit different. So say, okay, good, save my life, but don't steal my watch. So, says technically, he's not sure if the logic really applies. And then, since this institution that exempts the nation of Aids is a suffix, is a derabbanan, so it leans to say there might be a suffix derabbanan, which means we leave things back in the Iker Adin, and that really maybe he should be chayav in the shul. But it's an interesting question, especially because the case that he's not talking about is really more similar than the situations we read about today with people getting sued when they're involved in helping people medically. Is usually closer to the case in our Gemara, that it's not that there's an independent claim that while you were saving my life, you also stole the watch. It's that you didn't save my life well enough, or you broke some ribs while you were doing it, or that you caused some other medical problem. It usually is within the same act. And it's an interesting discussion to have. To what extent is the same logic of Meshuv Aveda, should it be applied if there was, let's say, in a Bezdin, a Din Torah, between patient and a doctor in a situation like this, to what extent should it be relevant? It's an interesting discussion to have. So that's one point I wanted to call your attention to. Another point, just an important tosfos to call attention to, just you should be aware of, because it's relevant also to understanding the logic of modu mitzvahs, and is a point that affected sugyas that we've seen so far. So just to reinforce here, so the Gemara explains why it is that modu b'miktsas is not basically migo, right? Essentially, modu b'miktsas is the anti-migo. That the idea that somebody should have to take a shvur because he acknowledges half of the debt is the opposite of migo. Because normally, you could say that since he could have gotten off completely by being kol for hakol, if he denies the whole thing, so then he'll be scot-free. So if he's modu b'miktsas, we should say migo, he could have denied everything and gotten off completely. So we should let him off completely here too. So the Gemara says that no, we don't say that, because the alternative is not really equally available. The idea that he could have just been called for a bakal is not really so simple for him, because ein adam meiz pana bifnei bal chova, which essentially sounds like it's calling it amigo d'haza, if you recall a little bit of Chazar from a few weeks ago, and that it seems like the Gemara is essentially saying that amigo d'haza doesn't work. Although we discussed that some of the Rishonim understand it to mean not that amigo d'haza never works, but amigo d'haza doesn't work for a shvua. And that maybe for Mamanus it does work, right? A little Chazar here, you recall this whole story. So we discussed sources in our parasha talk about Migo D'Haza, that seem to be referring to Migo D'Haza. Right, the first Mishnah was a situation where a man claims to a family member of somebody else that the land is not theirs, that he bought it from the ancestor. So there we discussed the question also. Migo, he could have said that they never had it in the first place. So is that a Migo D'Haza? If he's lying to them, and they know he's lying, so is that also called Ha'azim? So as we noted, then part of the issue is what is considered ha'aza. These are different types of chutzpah. Is chutzpah davka because you're lying in front of somebody who did you a favor? Or does it mean davka you're lying in front of somebody who knows that you're lying? Or is it just about the degree of lying in general? So it has nafkaminas because different cases will have different aspects. So for example, let's say a situation of pikadon. You didn't actually lend somebody money and do him a favor. You had him watch something for you. So he might want to lie to you, and he wouldn't necessarily have to be worried about lying in front of his beneficiary, or in terms of benefactor, if he's a beneficiary, in front of his benefactor, because there really isn't any benefit. He was just a shomer pikadon. So just it's important to be aware, this is a machlokas harishonim, what it means. So if you see this Tosfos, the last Tosfos in Daf Yud Ches Lamed Aleph, so Tosfos says, Chazak Eino Ademei is Panav. So says Tosfos, Lo Kamoshin Pirish Bekuntris Behagozel, De Eino Ademei is Lefi Sha'asalo Tova Shehalveyu, that you shouldn't say, like Rashi says in Bava Kama, that a person would not be in Lechutzif in front of somebody who did him a favor and lent him money. Avaba Pikadon May is. But if it was something that doesn't involve a favor, like pikadon, then he would be willing to be so brazen. Dim kain, but pikadon modu b'mitzvus nami hepater b'migo. Because if that were the case, then with a pikadon, so a modu b'mitzvus would also be pater through amigo. Migo di boy kofer hakol, because he has the alternative of denying the whole thing, and you don't have to worry about a chutzpah because there's no balchov there. Uvachol duchta mashma de modu b'mitzvus chayiv b'pikadon. And in all the cases, it seems that we say, even by pikadon, that Moed Mixas is chayiv, and he brings some cases here. So it's a skip to the second to last line here. It says, Ela Omer Beinu Tam, Dehainu Kigon Chazaka She'en Ha'isha Me'iza Panea Bifnei Baila. Right? This is actually similar to a different concept, the idea that a woman's not going to lie in front of her husband, and the idea being, She'en Lo Adam Panim Lichpur Hakol, that a person just doesn't have that degree of brazenness in general, that lying is harder to do an absolute lie than a partial lie, that seems to be the assumption. So to really come out and flat out deny something, that's much harder to do. And to lie as a matter of degree and say something that happened a little bit instead of how much it actually did happen, that's much easier for people to do. But to say something that happened absolutely didn't happen, so that's a harder degree of lie. It's also a less effective type of lie. So that's really what we mean. That a person just can't lie that much. You know, that essentially it's not really about b'fnei balchovo. It's that when it's a question of degree versus a question of absolute, so then that's where the ha'aza factor fits in. V'riva perish, eino demei is hecha shechavero makir b'shkaro be'im lahav. And the Riva has another view that a person, what it means is that a person won't lie when the other party knows he's lying. But again, that requires a greater degree of chutzpah that's not lying in general. So even if you're lying for the benefit of the third party, you're lying for the benefit of the Beis Din, but the other litigant knows you're lying. So it takes a greater degree of chutzpah to do that. So essentially, you find here 3 days in Rishonim what this principle means. This principle that Migo doesn't apply here because of the chutzpah factor. So what is chutzpah? So either the chutzpah is like Rashi, it's denying that somebody did you a favor. Or like Rabbeinu Tam, it's just any kind of extreme lie as opposed to a more moderate lie that's just a matter of degree. Or like the Riva, that it's about whether the other party knows that you're lying. And in the last two cases especially, it's not just a question then of chutzpah in the sense of just your discomfort, but it's also a question of effectiveness. Right? That if you could lie with a smaller degree as opposed to denying something happened completely, so you have a greater chance of being believed just in terms of human nature. As the Gemara says, and we always know, that a lie that has a little bit of truth is the only kind of lie that's effective. Complete false lies have a harder time getting somewhere. Most effective lies are based a little bit on truth. So if you say, yeah, I did borrow the money, but it was a lot less than you're saying, so then you're going to have an easier time just psychologically being believed than if you say, what, I never heard of you, I never borrowed anything from you. It doesn't, and then maybe he'll find witnesses that saw him handing money to you. So if you say, it never happened in the first place, so then that's a little bit harder. If you say, yeah, he handed me money, but it was half as much, So then that's going to be a little bit easier. And also the second opinion in Tosfos, that if the other party knows, again, in terms of effectiveness, that's also a factor. That if the other person doesn't know you're lying, so that you don't have to worry so much about how they may contradict you. If the other person knows you're lying, so then you have to worry, maybe he has some evidence you're not aware of, maybe he can prove it, and then just in terms of effectiveness, it's an issue. So essentially what I'm pointing out here is you have three different opinions in Rishonim about what this Meir's idea means, but with all of them, you could also ask another question, is that what do we mean when we say this alternative is not equally available? Does it mean simply that we have too much faith in your conscience, that your conscience is not going to let you be so brazen? Or it means that these are cases where the other lie is not an equal option because it's simply not going to work as well. And then, if it's going to be compromised for that reason, maybe it's not an effective mego.
Do Dayanim use these rules about lying in cases today, since many rabbis would say that people are much more brazen than lying?
So I discussed that. We mentioned that I think we related this in the year. I had a discussion with the Schechter and the Rosenzweig about this a few weeks ago. I think I mentioned this in the year. That in general, the Gemara has ideas like this, and we also have a principle elsewhere that seems to also be about chutzpah, that a person wouldn't lie about milsa David Leguye, that if it's going to eventually come out that he was lying, so then he wouldn't lie about that. So it's a shayla in Hilchos Lashon Hara about whether you can rely on that. Can you assume that something that's being said to you is true if you know that it'll come out that it was false otherwise? So it saw a quote in the name of Rabbi Yashiv that he said that Bezman is that people are very brazen and people would lie even in such circumstances and you can't rely on that idea. So it was reminiscent of what we heard from the Shechter in the past, I think, or from others, that Rav Soloveitchik had said when he heard Khrushchev lying to Nixon about having missiles in Cuba, he said that it's no longer true that Imam Khomeini is pondering about it, that the Milsa David Leguye, the Shakri Nishra, people are now more brazen and they're willing to lie. So at the time, Rav Rosenzweig mentioned, also Gizcha Zachary de Tosfos was mentioning, that Rishonim already said that at the time of the Rishonim, that it wasn't true anymore, that people do lie. Even when that requires a certain amount of brazenness. All right, also we've mentioned that in some cases you also have to know, is it about lying or maybe it's about a mistake? A person could make a mistake in a situation, you know, and not necessarily realize they're making a mistake. So halachah l'maaseh, you have to really know how and when to apply these things. All right, so with that, let's get to the Mishnah now on Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis. So far, so good. Any questions about anything? All right, so let's give a little bit of an introduction. I guess we won't get that far, but let's just try to give you a little bit of a sense. The Mishnah on Daf Yud Ches brings us into many different fascinating sugyas. Some of them are explicit in the Gemara. Some of them are a little bit less explicit. You have to figure them out through the Rishonim. But there are many, many, you really could spend months on this. You don't have months to spend on it, but there are a lot of wonderful sugyas which hopefully you will get a good sense of coming up. And even before we get to it, so we need a little bit of an introduction, that essentially we have seen in our parak themes of Ne'amanus and themes of Migo and Modim Mitzvos and Rov and the like. So now we're entering into another very important component of Choshen Mishpat and Eben Ezer, and that is, on the one hand, Eidus. We're going to talk about rules of testimony, but also specifically rules of shtaros. So shtaros are very mysterious. What exactly is the nature of a shtar? A shtar, on the one hand, we think we've all heard of them, contracts, legal documents, seems like something which is an inherent part of halacha when it comes to mamonos and when it comes to other interpersonal interaction and commitments. But the actual halachic nature of a shtar is quite complex. Rav Shechter, for example, has an important essay about this based on the Rav's teachings in his first sefer, in the Sefer Eretz Tzvi. And just to try to lay down some of the basics. So there is a fundamental problem with the shtar. So, to begin with, like, what would you characterize a shtar as? What is a shtar meant to accomplish? Particularly, let's say, in the context in which it comes up over here in this Mishnah. That, where, let's say you have a shtar, the shtar is going to relate to a transaction that took place. You want to use the shtar in order to say the other person owes you money, something like that. So what is the role of the shtar? What's the shtar supposed to accomplish? So you might think Eidus, right? That seems like a reasonable role. That Beis Din is a evidence-gathering body. So some of the evidence comes from people directly. And that's called testimony. And sometimes it'll come in written form, and that's a shtar. Problem is that we have a Gemara as a drasha from a pasuk that challenges this. What's that drasha? I know it's a Gemara that appears in Maseches Yevamos and Daf Lamed Aleph and Gitna and Daf Ayin Aleph. Says the Gemara that we have a drasha that concerning Eidus, it is Mipihem. Says the Gemara, Mipihem velo Mipi Ksavam. In other words, it sounds like the thrust of the Gemara is to say that Eidus has to be oral, has to be spoken, and cannot be written. So the Rishonim struggle now with a fundamental question that how do you have a concept of a shtar? Now, what's a shtar? So Morty was logical a few seconds ago when he said that a shtar is probably a form of Eidus. But then we have a fundamental problem. The Gemara says that Eidus has to be spoken, can't be written. So how do you reconcile that?
Can't it be a different type of Eidus?
It could
there's
be.
An Eidus that that pasuk was talking about, mm-hmm. is only a spoken type, and there's a different type as a shtar.
Certainly a worthy avenue to explore, but you have to then give it a little more substance. So what kind of Eidus is one, what kind is the other, and why should one work for one and one work for the other?
So I guess you don't, for a regular Eidus of witnesses, you can investigate them, you don't have to necessarily have them vetted by others, and a shtar has to have its own testimony written on it.
You say that a shtar itself constitutes a different type of Eidus,
right.
Which is true, but then it seems like still we have a problem of that. So how do we know that the Gemara is not including that? And presumably, you have to assume that whatever Eidus is would have to be complete enough to be effective. So it sounds like the Gemara is saying that the written version, whatever it has to contain, is not going to be acceptable, even if it contains whatever we need to know. So it sounds like it's a fundamental issue with the written version. Otherwise, we could have said that we're missing information in this case. And if we have enough information, then it's going to be enough. So it's certainly a good avenue to pursue, but we need to figure out how the different parts are going to have enough to make it work. Sammy?
I think it's maybe a little similar, but maybe the Gemara statement means is that every Eidus must have a component of, like an oral component to it. Mm-hmm. Meaning that when a man says that it can't be written, it means that it can't be only written. You have to also be able to express.
So that's interesting. So let's explore that for a second. I think it's actually different. I think what you're saying, both of what you're saying, has great substance to it. We need to figure out a little bit where that substance is going. So let's, if we have time, try to mention, let's say, three mahalchim today that you find in the Rishonim. So let's talk first about something which might be a little similar to that. There is a fascinating statement of Rebbe Natan. Rebbe Natan is the Rebbe Das Yochid on this. But he's based on the Gemara. So let's explain where he's coming from. And then you'll see why he says what he says. But again, my apologies that I didn't give you these makaris in advance. It was giving you that of the Gemara, but I'm happy to give you these, let's say, for tomorrow, for future stardom, so you can see them inside. But Rabbi Natan essentially says that this is a very limited exclusion. Mipihem, the lonely peak savan, is a very limited concept, that it only excludes a situation of somebody who is mute. Somebody cannot speak at all, an Elaine. So then he is excluded from testimony in Beis Din because of this drasha of Mipihem velo Mipi Ksavim. But if somebody could speak, so then he could do it in written form. So what's that based on? So it's based on the combination really of two Gemaras. That essentially he is taking one line, Rabbi Natan is taking one line from the Gemara in Gittin, That Beit HaTam I just quoted is a Tosfos in Yevamos and Lamed Aleph in the base. But it's based on the Gemara Gittin and Dafayin Aleph. And Beit HaTam is interpreting that Gemara based on a different principle you find elsewhere in Shas, which radically redefines what it's saying. Essentially, what am I talking about? The Gemara says in Gittin and Dafayin Aleph that let's have a situation where a person who is unable to speak can testify. So it says the Gemara, how's he going to do that? He can't speak, how's he going to testify? So the next statement is, well, he could write down his testimony. So then the Gemara says, no, that's not going to work. Mi pihen velo mi pikso. It can't be written, has to be spoken. So Rabbeinu Tam's bichidish is to say that that's the only exclusion of Mipiyim Velo Mipiksav. But that somebody who could speak is able to do it through written form. So you could ask, how could that make any sense? If the Gemara in Gittin just told you that it's got to be spoken, it's got to be spoken, and that's why the Elaim can't do it. So why should we allow a non-Elaim to do it in written form? What possible advantage does he have? If they're both doing it in written form, so then they're both subject to the same problem. So there is a principle in Shas, which applying it here is very interesting, and that's what Rabbeinu Tam does. He quotes this other idea as well. That we have a concept, I think we spoke about this, maybe we didn't speak about this. Kolaroi Labila, did we speak about this year at all? Okay. Yeah, we did. By Shofar. No? By
the Rambam.
Yeah, the Rambam by Shofar maybe? Shemei Kaona or something. Alright, anyway, there's a concept of Kolaroi Labila that the Gemara says in Maseches Menachos that if you have a L'chachila and a B'dieved version of something, so it means that if you don't do the L'chachila, you can get away with the B'dieved. But the Gemara says that the L'chachila version has to be at least possible. And if it's impossible for you to do the L'chachila version, so then even the B'dieved version is not good. So basically, B'dieved means that you can get away without the L'chachila as long as at least it was a theoretical possibility. But if it wasn't even possible, then you're really in trouble. And the phrase is kolaroi levila because the context is it's about a mincha. The Torah says you have to take a korban mincha, a flower offering, has to be mixed up, has to be bowled. So the Gemara says that even if it has to be bowled, but if it's not, it's still good. Even if it's not mixed up, it's still acceptable. But, says the Gemara, let's say it's packed in so tightly that you couldn't mix it. It would be impossible. Not just eat it, but it would have been physically impossible to do it. So then, says the Gemara, that's no good, because the rule is, kol ha'ra'i labila, Ain bilaso makabas. That if it's theoretically possible to mix it, then you don't do it, not so terrible. But kol she'eino roi lebila, if it's not even possible, it's not roi, it can't even be done, so then bilaso makabas. Then the lack of bila becomes a problem. So that principle you find in other areas of halacha as well. That you can get away without certain perfect details, but they have to at least be theoretically possible. If it couldn't even have happened, so then it's not going to work. So apparently, Rabbeinu Tam understands, and he quotes this Gemara, quotes these two Gemaras together, so he understands that the Gemara in Gittin is giving you another example of kolaroi labila. The Gemara is saying not that Eidus always has to be spoken, but that it has to be potentially speakable. If it's not an unspeakable act, so then it's going to be kosher. It's only when the aid is not able to speak and has to testify through writing that it's no good. Now again, Zedas Yochid, this is a kind of a radical interpretation. Right? Basically, what's he saying if you think about it? What he's really saying is that this is not a psul, the Pia Velomi Piksavam, is not about Eidus. It's about the aid. It's a radical position. He's saying that what the Gemara is saying is that the aid, asher lo yagid, the pasuk says, it has to be somebody who can be magid. That's a halacha, not an eidus, but in the aid has to be someone who can talk. And if that person is a qualified aid, then he can submit his aidos in writing too. But if he can't even talk, so that is possible, and therefore the option of being able to write it is no good. It's a hard to understand interpretation of why that should be. So it's not the view of the other Rishonim, but that's Rebbe Tam essentially saying that it's not about the aidos, it's about the aid. So that's the question in a second, which parenthetically, to build on what Aryeh was saying before about the advantage of a live aid versus a shtar, you know, that a little bit you could understand more easily. You could say that I need, like you find in contemporary courts today also, right? Let's say when somebody wants to testify on a video recording rather than come to court. So sometimes they allow it, it's a big danger for the person, or the person is no longer alive, but it's always a whole problem, and the other attorney will always argue, because you could have a very detailed video testimony, but it can't be subject to cross-examination. You can't argue with it. You can't talk to it. So there's an inherent advantage to having a live witness in front of you, and something that's not able to engage in give and take is not going to be the same kind of thing. So you could hear, if that's what we said, that you have to have the aid there and not his written testimony. So Rabbeinu Tam is saying something else. He's saying it's not about the testimony. The testimony could be written. It's just that the aid, to be a kosher aid, has to be somebody who's able to speak. It's a hard interpretation. It's all.
So what do we say, I'm not sure if this is before that, but what do we say about an aid who died after, you know, so now do we need to find him, or?
Well, it depends at what point he, I mean, it's a longer question, so I'm going to push it off for now, but it depends when how far he got into the testimony, and what happened if he died before giving any testimony, then he just really isn't in a position to serve
as an
aid.
What I mean is that once the shark's written now, once the aid dies, the star shouldn't be good.
Right, so not necessarily, but that we'll have to get to. That'll probably be later, but keep that in mind. All right, so that's one interpretation. So we have Rabbeinu Tam, again it's a Das Yachid, but that's one way of seeing the stira between the existence of Shtaros and the Drasha, Mipihem, below Mipiksava. So that's Rabbeinu Tam, that no, Shtaros are good, and written testimony is always good, unless the aid himself is not able to give spoken testimony, and that's the whole impact of the Drasha, Mipihem, below Mipiksava. Again, that's not the commonly held interpretation. Another somewhat surprising, but a little bit more mainstream, but also probably not the interpretation, is the Rambam. So the Rambam is a good marmakom to have if you had somebody giving you marmakomos today. But so instead of that, I will read it to you, and you can look at it inside tomorrow. The Rambam says a fascinating thing here. The Rambam is in Hilchos Eidos, in Perek Gimel, Halacha Dalet. Says the Rambam as follows. Din Torah, she'ein mekabel eidus, lo b'dinei mamonos v'lo b'dinei nefashos, ela mipi ha'edin. Right, so the din of the Torah is that you don't accept testimony, whether in monetary matters or in capital cases, other than through the mouth of the witnesses. So namar al pishnayim eidim, mipihem v'lo miksav yada. Okay, so that's the din, that you have to have spoken testimony. Aval mi divrei sofrim shechoschin dini mamonos be'edus shebishtar. However, there is a din mi divrei sofrim that you accept edus from a shtar. Afal pi she'ein ha'edim kayamim kidei shlo tinal deles b'fnei lovin. But there is a new din, right? Here's that word again, divrei sofrim. And we've mentioned in the past, there's some ambiguity. Does that mean it's a din d'rabbanan? It means a drasha, minhag Torah, through Chazal. So here too, you have a lot to try to figure out what exactly he means here. But let's assume he means it's a din d'rabbanan, that a shtar should not work minhag Torah. But it is a taka problem, mipiyim v'lo mipiksavim, that knocks out shtaros. But come Chazal, and they made an institution of shtaros for the purposes of mamonos. Why? Because otherwise no one's going to lend money. We're concerned, that's again a theme of the Shemitah year, we have a Prozbul, we're concerned about creating disincentives against helping people out, against lending money. So therefore, Chazal made a takana that a shtar should work. They wished upon the shtar so that there should be this venue for people to be able to collect their borrowed money. So they're lent money. So if that's the case, so that's a big chiddush, right? It's essentially saying, sounds like, and again, there's a lot of dispute about what Divrei Sofer means here. It sounds like he's saying Shtar is Rabban. So as you can imagine, it starts a whole firestorm. One question maybe we'll mention in a minute, if we have a moment, like what the Kesef Mishnah and others ask. But the Ramban, in the Sefer HaMitzvos, in the Shrashim, the Ramban says, what are you talking about? Right, we have shtaris that seem to be Daraisa, right? Without getting into the question of Ksuba Daraisa, although it's a little bit relevant. But even if we assume Ksuba is Darabban, so what about Get? Isn't that a shtar? Right? Isn't that a concept in a Torah? You're telling me there's no such thing as a shtar Daraisa? What about Shtar Kedushin, which we don't really use so much, as we mentioned, that it exists as one of the Kenyani Kedushin. Is that only Rabbanan? So many Achronim have an approach. If you look in the back of the Shapsi Frankel, where he has the Mar Makomo, so you can see this approach and a list of like, the whole long list of, I think it's like three words to give the answer, and then a whole long list underneath of all people who say this answer. So what might be an answer? Right, well, the Rambam saying it's Drabanan, and yet we know that there are Shtaros that are Daraisa. So what might be an approach, Ari?
So that it's a Drash Daraisa that he's calling Divrei Sofer.
Also, there is some discussion about that, but let's assume that he means Mamish Drabanan. There are those who take that path, but more straightforward path, let's assume that he means Drabanan. How does that reconcile with the existence of Shtaros that we know to be Daraisa?
So Shtaros Daraisa, it has to be because it itself is not the Eidos, but rather that the Eidos is there, and then the Shtar is just on top of the Eidos. As opposed to over here, these Shtars are actually the Eidos.
So I think you're exactly right, except to flip it a little bit. You have the right kind of distinction, but you have to sharpen it a little bit. Is that what you wanted to say? So, okay, so this is probably what you would have said had you called on you first. That Sal, you're on the right track, but I'll like kind of move it from the other end. That essentially what they're saying is that yes, and this is very resonant if you think about it. That mipiyem below mipiksavam. So that's saying that a shtar cannot serve as edus, but not every shtar is about edus. So a shtar, let's say a get, that's not the edus. The get, the shtar is effecting the divorce. And so too, if you had a shtar kiddushin, that is effecting the kiddushin. You can have a shtar kinyan, that exists, min ha-Torah. But what we're talking about here is that edus should come through a shtar. It's a whole different concept. The idea that a shtar should be used in Bezdin as a source of testimony. So the Rambam is saying, that's a din d'rabbanan. So that you don't necessarily have to ask me from the get or shtar kedushin. That's a whole different concept. Yes, shtaros contracts exist min ha-Torah, but the idea that it should be accepted as testimony in Bezdin, that's not necessarily the case. So that's maybe where the Rambam is coming from. Morty,
can you make a distinction? The Rambam says that it's only for game mamonos that you use this.
Yeah, that basically his idea is that shtar shouldn't work as testimony in anything. That basically P.M. Bolin Piksavra means that there's no such thing as testimony from a shtar. But if that was the case, then people who loaned money could end up losing out, because the only proof that it happened might be the contract, might be the shtar. And if they can't bring that as proof, so then they're going to lose out. So because that was the one area where they were worried about this, they weren't worried about, you know, Dina Fasha, people won't be executed because of written evidence, that's not a problem. But there was a social problem, people won't lend money, so therefore there was a need to do this. Hi.
And there are shtaros that might be daraisa that are purely mononymous, like ksuba might be daraisa.
Oh, right, so that's an interesting thing then to consider. So if you say ksuba is daraisa, so the question is then what is it meant to accomplish? You know, is it meant to create the chiyuv between the two, or is it meant to be some sort of edus, which itself is an interesting path to pursue. So we're just about out of time. I'll just mention one more thing, and then we'll have to continue this tomorrow. Tomorrow you see the parsha, the Aliyah is relatively short, so if you want to use Seder to look at some of these Rishonim inside, or look at the parsha to both, you should probably have time to do both. I'll send you a list of what I mentioned today. But we'll get soon to, again, this is a treasure trove of many sugyas going to come out of this daf. But so there is another approach that Rav Soloveitchik favored, and that was a lot of the basis for the Kutras Hashtaros that Rav Shechter published in Eretz HaTzvi that we'll say more about. It's really the approach of the Balamor. The Balamor in the third parak of Yevamos and Daf Tes, Daf Beharif, to that Gemara and Daf Lamed Aleph. So it's basically Daf Yomi not so long ago. So the Balamor has an approach which you see a little bit of just if you have Exubis in front of you. So there is a Tosfos on Daf Chaf and Midbeis, which has something along these lines. But that basically the exclusion is Mipihem Lo Mipi Ksavam and not Lo Mipi Ksavo. What's the difference? Meaning that a shtar that's supposed to serve as the testimony of two witnesses, if they were going to write down their testimony instead of saying it, so then that's the psul. But a shtar, which is the Das HaNeskai, that basically the individual who's a litigant who wants to put his claim or his hodah in document form, so that could be valuable min haTorah. That could be valid min haTorah. So just as one line, if you look at the Tosfos and Chaf in the Beis, towards the middle of the page, just it's basically I'll just read them one line here. It says Aval Hacha Shekosu Veiduso Shalom Midas Halove Lo Chashiv Shtara. That if you try to write down your testimony without the consent of the litigant, so then that's not going to be considered a shtar. Shtar means that one of the parties actually acknowledges something in writing, so that could be valid on a level min haTorah. But as edus, that's not going to work. So essentially, we're out of time here, so we'll dive in mincha. I just want to make a quick point here. So what are we getting at? So all this background is necessary just to understand, first of all, what a shtar is min haTorah, and our Mishnah is going to discuss the concept of kiyum shtaris, which we'll explain more about next time, but the notion that the shtar has to be upheld, has to basically have some type of additional process in order to verify what exactly does that mean, mahalach, as a guideline, that is something we'll have to explore. That's what our Mishnah is really dealing with. In order to understand that, so you have to have a background in what a shtar is, min haTorah, and what it isn't, and we'll have to take it from there. So just quickly, what did we speak about today? So we spoke a little bit more about the covet of the kala. We talked about the question of standing for a kala, and standing for a chasen. Is it based on a mitzvah? Is it based on covet? We mentioned Rizkus Liberstein's discussion about whether you should use a gold cup for the benching or for the kala. We talked about the gemara about Meshuv Aveda, is pater from a shvua for kofar bakol. So the question is, should we extend that same logic to a paramedic or a doctor who's accused of stealing the watch? There's Zilberstein's discussion about that, the possible chiluk between the etzem hadavar being incomplete and some type of side complaint. And then we talked about what does another mei tamav mean. We saw Tosfos here at three opinions. Either it means Rashi's view that you don't like, that the guy did you a favor, or two other opinions, Rabbeinu Tam, that it's just too big of a lie, it doesn't matter who it is you're lying to, or the Riva, that it's about lying to somebody who knows that you're lying. And we said all of those are subject to a different question. Is the issue that you don't have enough chutzpah, or is the issue that the lie is simply not equal because it has different effectiveness, and therefore maybe we don't assume that you would pursue a less effective path equally? And then we talked about a little bit of a hakdama to shtaros, about the fact that a shtar seems to have a fundamental problem with it. On the one hand, we know shtaros exist. On the other hand, we had a drush in the Gemara of Yipihan, so how does that allow for shtaros? So we saw Rabbeinu Tam, and Yevamos is a very limited reading, but it just excludes an Elaim, which the Gemara says an Elaim can't testify through a shtar because of Mipihan, but he extends it to say that that's all it means, that it only excludes the Elaim, but a person who can speak, he can testify in writing, and he bases that on the whole idea of Kolaroi Labila. We found that to be a little bit of a surprising idea. We said that it means that this halacha is not about Eidos, but it's about the Eid himself, which is a little bit surprising. And then we saw the Rambam. The Rambam says that really Ishtar does not work min haTorah, and the whole institution is only midrabanan because of Shlosh Tanodalos with Neilovin. And the question is asked, first of all, what does he mean by Divrei Sofrim, a whole separate discussion, but assuming he means it's Drabanan, so what about the fact that we know many shtaris exist min haTorah? So the Acharonim explained that no, that's the Ramban's question, and the Acharonim explained that no, that a shtar that is like shtar kinyan, yes, that exists min haTorah, but a shtar as eidos, that's what's excluded through Rupiyam Olam Rupiyam Zava. And then we saw the Balamor, mentioned the Balamor in Tosfos, that it's mipik savam, and not mipik savo. That yes, the Edim don't put their testimony in the Shtar, but the Das HaMitzchayev, the individual who is a litigant, he can put his words in the Shtar, and that will have meaning, and we'll have to see how all that affects the Din of Kiyum Shtaros, which is the background of this Mishnah. All right, who wants to daven for us? Any volunteers in the next second? Okay, Aryeh? Ashri Yashiv Yisachar.